Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Robert Chu, I have known for years. He was an actor. He was gay. People never, ever think that. He taught classes for kids, just kids, not privileged kids. And he also, there were so many kids on the show, they would be corralled and he could teach them. He was as kind as he was large. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Hey everybody, I'm Kobe.
And I'm Dave.
And welcome to The Wire Strip Podcast. We're the podcast that goes through each episode of The Wire week by week.
Yes, and you don't just hear from the two of us. You also hear from the people that made The Wire. You guys as well will also feature.
Yes, definitely. If you do want to follow us, guys, we are at The Wire Strip on Twitter and Instagram.
But why don't we go straight into our chat about Season 4, Episode 2, Soft Eyes.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
Got the fire and the fury.
Right, here we are, Kobe. We are on the streets waiting for Bubbles to swing by in his trolley.
Yeah, I need some white t-shirts.
White tees.
Like crazy.
The amount of white tees that people are going through in Baltimore.
Yeah, what's going on there?
There's a real like real churn. Must get really sweaty, I guess.
Well, yeah. Something special about a white t-shirt. You can chuck it on any time. You can use them for cleaning your surfaces. Maybe that's what they do. They wear it once, clean the surfaces, throw
yeah,
it away.
That's got to be it.
Not very environmental.
Buy another one from Bubbles' depot.
Exactly. You know, Bubbles is going to come around once a day, re-up on your white tees.
Re-up. What? Well, why don't we kick off there? Why don't we? Because we meet Bubbles in this episode.
Always a pleasure.
So good to see him.
Yeah.
And he's got a new intern, as he describes him.
Yeah, Sherrod.
A new sort of Johnny Weeks, but quite a different sort of character.
Yeah, he's already one. This is, I sense Bubble just says, I need to get my arm around this kid, or otherwise he's just going to go wayward. Whereas Johnny Weeks is someone he could perform hijinks with and get high with. I don't know if Sherrod gets high. I can't remember if that happens, but...
He does. Yeah, yeah.
But this
well,
is
they seem to really imply it.
But this is certainly, I'm going to take care of this kid, because I'm going to be an uncle to this kid. I'm going to be father to this kid.
Well, almost literally, he pretends to be his uncle at the end, doesn't he? Yeah, he is. You're right. He's like, he is a protege to Bubbles, but in a different way than Johnny Weeks. Because as you said, like, Johnny Weeks was a protege to the hijinks almost. But like, Bubbles has gone quite legit now, isn't he?
He's trying to stay on that kind of straight and narrow attack.
Yeah, there's no more fishing lines and Wile E. Coyote moves.
Shaking ladders with people.
Right, he's legit. He's got, and his trolley has expanded.
He's got two trolleys
now
stuck together.
Yeah,
beautiful.
And I love the. I mean, Andrew Rior is just sublime. But like the way he like describes to Sherrod that like we should be splitting up. You know, he's like he can see his empire is expanding, but Sherrod's not quite up to the task, is he?
No, yeah. His mental arithmetic isn't that good. And to be fair, Sherrod's what, 14, 15? I hated doing like mental arithmetic. I'm quite good at maths, but you know, I always had a calculator. So I was always shit at that kind of stuff. And working in the shop or working behind a bar and working out what how much people owed me, I was like, put it in the till, mate. That's what I do. But also, there's also, he knows there's not that spark about Sherrod as well.
Yeah.
Generally. And he gives Sherrod quite a tricky mental arithmetic test, like later on, I thought.
Yeah, he throws in, like, yeah, what, yeah. 6x4 plus 9x8 or something like
that's
like
bit,
that.
That's
yeah.
a bit dark, mate.
Just, just go straight to the hardcore algebra, man.
Can you integrate that and differentiate? Like, no. Anyway, maths terms, guys. But yeah, I thought it was a bit harsh on Sherrod, but also, I think. You know, he wants something from Sherrod which he maybe doesn't have there.
There is a sort of a fatherly vibe from him, for sure. He wants Sherrod to succeed. And it is one of the sweetest moments when they show up at school to register and he pretends to be his uncle. I mean, again, my heart was aching there.
He can't even remember what grade he was when he left high school.
No, he knew it had been a few years ago. But I mean, that's cutting a tragic... Yeah. Plot there, isn't it? Again,
that's it.
So much tragedy this season.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love the double take, though, when he goes past Prez.
Yeah, I like that. It's a nice touch.
It's like, what the fuck are you doing here?
This episode is really good at, like, tying all the plots together and, like...
It always takes a couple of episodes to, like, build people in.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
To each season. But, yeah, of course, that's what we love about it.
There's so much... Like, all these... They all feel like disparate plots, but they all start to influence each other in this episode, with Valček at the heart of it once again.
Well, let's get to... All right, let's lead into the Valček bit. And it starts with a cold open. Herc is there. We talked about last episode, Herc.
Oh, yeah.
Not...
Ooh.
Herc not getting quite on with his partner in crime. So he goes, well, fuck it, I'm going to find the mayor because we need to get to such and such a place because it's presidential stuff, electoral stuff happening. And he finds the mayor getting a blowjob off a lady who was actually in the preceding episode, I noticed this time.
And gives him a little bit of a look in episode one.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit of a...
I'll give you a blowjob later look.
Yeah, that old chestnut.
So that first call that I missed, it was weeks and weeks apart that when my mother came to visit to say the HBO people called.
This is the absolutely lovely Sandy McCree, totally unlike her on-screen persona, Delonda Bryce.
Had my mother got the message to me on time, and I went in for the audition, which I'm sure I would have gotten. It was not for Delonda. It was for the mayor's secretary. So I missed it. Thank you, Lord. Because I'm sure I would have gotten out.
So this is awkward. It's an awkward moment.
It is.
You know, that awkward moment when you walk in on your boss. And Herc does what we would probably all do and hurriedly closes the door and walks away.
That, yeah. I mean, this is... I mean, we talked about in the previous episode about there being laughs, and this is played for laughs.
But Herc's not laughing later. He's really worried about his
really
job.
Really shitting himself.
So he goes to Carve to get some advice. Carve says, this is above my pay grade. Calls in Valček. And Valček, it's so good to see Valček again. He's such a character.
Well, before we go straight to Valček, it's so good to see Herc and Carve together.
Oh, right, yeah.
And just in the car. They're about to... They see Donut. This is an ancillary part. Donut's still stolen the car. And Herc and Carve spot it. And they're about to... do their kind of hijinks chasing after the kids. But just that scene in the car with those two together bouncing off each other was delightful.
And actually, we forgot to say in the last episode, we get a nice, over these few episodes with Carver, we get a nice idea of how he's progressed as a police officer and the fact that he has learned so much from Bunny last season, where
absolutely.
Bunny's like, you know, that's not policing what you're doing. It's you got to learn their names. And now, it's like so rewarding when you see Carve
take it on board. Yeah,
knows all their names. And when you see Herc and Carve back together and they're doing the same thing they were doing in season three, they're busting in and they're about to go on their chase. Like, and you know, Herc's about to flick on the Shaft music, and it feels like last season. But Carve's like, hang on a second. I know all these kids. I know where they hang out. I'll just go get them later. And it's just like, that's a brilliant moment for me. And
totally.
And the scene later, we're kind of jumping around a bit now, but the scene when he goes to them and confronts them, Carve's now doing good policing, where he's like firm and authoritative, but also a bit sort of friendly and bantery, right?
Yeah, when he calls that name, and the name is like, fuck yeah, yeah, that's right, I know where you live.
I do think that is one of the messages, that there are some officers that are highlighted in the series that seem to get it, you know, including Carver, who looks to Colvin, you know, as a mentor, Daniels as a mentor.
This is the voice of Kristen Henning. She's the director of the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative, and she also wrote the book Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth.
You know, he starts off, I mean, Carver's sort of the classic evolution, right? At least in this series, where he starts off partnered with Herc and really have this sort of simple-minded, brutish policing strategy around policing drugs in the neighborhood. And these low-level offenses, harassing the kids, using physical violence where necessary. In their view, right? But, you know, over time, he begins to learn from folks like, you know, Colvin, who says to him, like, look, you know, have you cultivated any relationships in the community, right? Do you have any folks who are going to give you information about crime in the community? Who are your go-tos? I think that was one of his changing moments. I think also just officers who really get proximate, if you will, who really get to know people in the community. So I think turning back to Randy, Carver and Randy's relationship was ultimately a real turning point for him. Also, Carver and Bodie's relationship over time becomes a really important moment. This is what I call, you know, sort of getting proximate with the young people in the community. You see them for who they are and see them for their potential.
I tell you, bottom line is community policing.
This, frankly, sensational voice is the one and only Chad Coleman, who, of course, played Cutty.
And allow those who are from that area to school others, even if others have a higher rank. Allow them to school you and help show you the most effective way to go after or approach these young men. But it's community policing. You've got to gain their trust. And if you gain their trust and you're consistent, you'll be doing something that many of their fathers are not. And it's going to pay off.
Carver delivers Herc to Valchek.
Yeah, and Valchek treats the news very differently than Herc. He sees it as what it is, of an opportunity.
Yeah.
Right? And he says that careers have been launched on a hell of a lot less than this.
Absolutely. You spied your time. He's, no matter what you're thinking about breaking yourself, he's shitting himself, you know, an order 10 more. So yeah. Just bide your time. He'll come to you, all friendly like, offer you a position.
Yeah.
And
let's see how that plays
let's
out.
Let's see how that plays episode. Out. Absolutely. But yeah, Valchek was happy as a pig in shit. By the way, mate, when you make it, just remember you owe me a favor, and that's all he wants. That's what Valchek says.
It's such a good line, because that little bit shows you that's what Valchek's whole career has been built on, right? Mm. All these little favors.
I read it on the page and I'm thinking, oh, okay, this is going to be fun. I catch him catching a blowjob. And
this is the man that brought Herc to life. This is Dominic Lombardozzi.
The thing with the show was you open up the script, you scan through the script, you want to see if you make it to the very end of the script. You want to look at all your stuff. You want to make sure there's no bullet holes, don't get shot. You're in an ambulance. You're laying on the floor. You're like, okay, I made it through another episode. And then you go forward. I didn't read much into any of that stuff. I just, whatever was on that page, I tried to give David and company the best I could. What was on the page. I at some point I stopped. I had to leave it there.
Well, speaking of favors and Valchek, we get that with the politics plot in this episode, don't we? So this is where the plots kind of overlap. So why don't we do a little bit on the homicide? So we get a state's witness is murdered.
Yeah.
The homicide team pick it up. Landsman leaks it to Valchek, and then Valchek leaks it to Carchetti.
Yeah.
And then Carchetti.
Does he leak it or like swing into his office dancing?
Yeah.
Dancing a maypole.
Right?
Is that a leak?
Such a horrible man, but such a wonderful character to watch. So just, yes, that's a nice way to put it. But and then Carchetti drops it on Royce live on TV.
Yeah.
In
the debate.
What is a pretty awesome moment. And I think what I really like about how they shot this is you see they show you the reaction in Carchetti's office and they show you the reaction in Royce's camp.
Mm.
And it's a stark contrast.
Nice and day, yeah. Absolutely.
Nobody in Royce's, everyone in Royce's camp has got their hands in their head basically like, oh no.
A year ago, I wrote the mayor a letter. I have copies for anyone who wants one. I begged him to spend the money and make witness protection a priority. He ignored me. I even teamed up with our legislative leaders, Delegate Watkins and others, to get matching funds for witness protection approved in Annapolis. And incredibly, those matching funds were never claimed by this administration. Now, to mention this now may be exploitive. I don't know. I only know it's true. And on such truths, I ask the voters of our city to consider a change.
I like that kind of Valchek is at the genesis of the season again, just like season two when it, with his stained glass window, which kicked off, basically led to the death of Frank Sobotka. Here we are.
Don't mind nothing.
Valchek coming in, swinging around the maypole, as you said, and he's set this series of events. in order, which is suddenly put Carchetti back on the map.
Valchek is a catalyst, is what you're saying. A catalyst for mayhem.
He is.
That's
he's
right.
He's an agent of chaos.
He is.
So we find out who Naaman's dad is.
Yeah, Weebay.
Yeah.
And you can see, obviously, Weebay's shadow is huge and looms large over the whole of Baltimore, on the western side at least. Mm-hmm. Naaman... You take one look at Naaman and think he's not got Weebay's front at all. Obviously, Naaman's, what, 14 here? But if you look at someone like Michael, and if you said Michael was Weebay's son, you'd be like, okay, I can get that. I can see that. But Weebay is not.
Michael's got the street smarts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Naaman's not got much about him, does he? Like, because Weebay is smart.
Yeah.
Like, and you can tell, like, what I really like about this scene is, like, the dynamic of this, like, it's a really familiar dynamic of the parents telling the kid, you know, chastising the kid.
Yeah, cut your hair.
Cut your hair. Come on, straighten up. You're not working hard enough.
Mm.
But they're like, it's when you take a step back, you're like, this is a man serving multiple life sentences for murder. That was his job. And this is the mother saying, hey, our son's not doing good enough at his drug dealing job.
Yeah.
This is just like, this is par for the course. But it's the same situation that any parent would face. It's just a job to them.
So we spoke to Delonda Bryce, a.k.a. Sandy McCree, about this. And she's one of the most hissable characters in TV. Rightly so. But Sandy loves it at the same time.
Yeah.
Because
she's excellent.
She plays it so perfectly.
Yeah.
And it is, if this was a pantomime, as soon as she comes onto stage, people would be because you're right,
she's behind you, Naaman.
Yeah. Their family business, based on what Weebay was doing, was murder and drug dealing and all the bad things.
Yeah.
And she's trying to get her son to follow that path, which is, if he follows that path, he's going to be at best in jail.
Yeah.
At worst, dead before his time.
But that's just, you know, that's just a job to her. That's the life. It's the life that she's
accustomed to. Yeah.
She really reminds me of D'Angelo's mother.
Yeah.
Very similar vibe. This sort of just like institutionalized sort of family member in the trade. And
but I think D'Angelo's mother has a bit more about her. I think she knows how it works a bit more.
Yeah.
Where I think Naaman's mum is just like, off you pop.
She
get those drugs in,
but she's still trying to shape her son into, you know, the man. She's trying to still make a success of him.
Yes.
And she's still in her own way, and I agree she's very hissable, but she is still trying to be a good mother in a way, but she's also spoiling him like a mother would, you know, at the end of the episode, you know, she's telling him, I'm not giving you money for school clothes because you need to go work. She's trying to instill a work ethic in him.
Absolutely, that's fair. That's absolutely fair.
But then ultimately, like a lot of parents would, and you know, just wants to spoil him and gets him nice things and gets him all the clothes. And when you get a glimpse into Naaman and her life at the end of this episode, it's like, it's a really nice apartment, and especially when you contrast it to like what we see of Dookie's life, it's like these boys are going to the same school and the same class, they're in the same network of friends, but their lives are totally different. Right,
massive contrast. Absolutely.
Naaman's playing Halo 2, and you know he's playing Halo 2 because they emblazoned the logo of that video game all over the front of it.
No point I've ever seen. I've never played a game and seen, like, never played Sonic the Hedgehog and had Sonic the Hedgehog the as name. A watermark.
Right?
Across the bottom of it.
I was obsessed with that because clearly some savvy brand marketer at Microsoft was like, sorry, you got to have the name of the game on there at all times. They cut a long deal with them, Microsoft, because Halo was in the previous season.
Yeah, wasn't Minota playing Halo last season?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a clean house. He had anything he wanted. I remember that first episode, which was one of my audition episodes, the fish episode and the clothes. When I told him he wasn't going to get anything and he comes downstairs, you know, with all those jerseys and stuff. Some people equate nurturing, educating, empowering with by buying and giving, you know, like it's a symbol of freedom. And it's not. I think it's knowledge, it's education, it's the self-esteem and the power of your presence and the love of yourself that's worth more than anything material. That's what I think. So in her eyes, her love was like money and to, you know, just support by giving, by buying.
I had no idea what it meant to be weeping, son. But they were all very like, oh, this is a big deal. Like, you're going to be weeping, son.
This is, of course, the one and only Naaman, played brilliantly by Julito McCullum.
And I was like, okay, cool. And then I watched that first season. I was like, I'm going to be this killer maniac son. What's going on here? But it was cool, man. It was cool. I think even in my brain, man, expected that this character was going to turn into like a Weebay-ish kind of character just automatically because of how menacing this guy was. And I just loved the fact that they made Naaman completely different from his dad. And I think that's something that we don't talk enough about in these communities, man. That these you're not always cut from the same cloth. And I think it's okay, especially I think sometimes we miss the point that these kids were like 14. You know what I mean? It's Weebay, this 30-year-old, however old man is. Yeah, he's lived the life to become a Weebay. I think we missed the part that these kids were kids, man, and you're not always born into being a murderer or born into being this broken guy. Sometimes it's created in you. And I love the fact that you saw that his son wasn't, it just wasn't him. And I love that it was very different.
Right. As you all know, we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/thewirestripped. But we now have another way you can help us out and the Ella Thompson Fund.
Yeah, so if you guys are listening on Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe to us to get a lot of the same benefits as a Patreon account, but it makes it easier if you want to help contribute to the lovely people at Ella Thompson Fund, who, just to remind you, I'm sure we've said a few times this episode already, but they help support underprivileged kids in Baltimore in the way that Cutty did in The Wire.
So you can get access to our episodes early. You can get access to our full interviews with the cast and crew, including our extended interview with David Simon.
No adverts on there as well. And also, Basking in the Glory, they help you out a lot of lovely people in Baltimore and the kids there. It's simple. If you're on Apple Podcasts, scroll up the feed now, and there's a button for you to click on, and it costs less than the price of a coffee every month to support lots of lovely people.
So when we're hanging out with the boys, You talked about Officer Walker approaching Randy. What happens before this is Marlowe and his gang come up to the stoop, come up to where the boys are hanging out, give them $200 each to get their school clothes. Just get yourselves some nice clothes, go boys. School's coming back. You make sure you look right. And Michael goes, nah, I'm not having that. I don't want to owe anyone anything. And this intrigues Chris Partlow and Marlowe, which is definitely interesting. But of course, the other guys are snatching away the money. And I was really gutted that Dookie wasn't there because he needs the money more than anyone else.
I know, right? Yeah.
Okay. It's like, where's Dookie?
Get Dookie some new clothes, man.
But the teacher, the deputy head, gave Dookie some clothes via messenger.
That's a sweet scene.
It is.
But also quite disturbing.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kids getting the money's really good. Wow, that's a good scene. Because that tells you so much about Marlowe, because what a smart move that is from
gets
his point of view.
Gets the kids on side, yeah.
Gets the kids on side from that young an age. Mm. They make sure they know where that money's coming from and who his name is. But also you see that Marlowe has an eye for talent, right? Because he spots Michael's got something about him, right?
Yeah.
That's actually more interesting to him that he, and then that he goes over to kind of confront him nominally, but he's kind of probing him to test him, and Michael passes the test by defying him, and he stares, doesn't say a word, and just stares him down, which is a hard thing to do looking into those shark eyes. Like, we've talked about Marlowe's shark eyes. So Marlowe, suddenly he's on Marlowe's radar, like, as you know, potential. You can see the hunger in Marlowe's eyes here, right?
Absolutely different class of kid on the stoop.
Right, yeah, exactly, because it tells you so much about Michael. Michael's got, we see Michael, wow, we learned so much about Michael in this episode, because we know that he's willing to work in the drug trade. Mm-hmm. So he picks up some work. He picks up Naaman's job with Bodie on the corner. And he's good at it, right? Because we see this, you know, the customers try to swindle him, get more pills. And he's like,
true.
Absolutely no way. Bodie also, like Marlowe, sees the potential in Michael. And he's like, please work for me. Don't go to school, man. I will give you money. And he tries.
What are you going to go to school for? Lots of reasons.
I don't know, buddy. But he won't do it. So Michael's a real mystery to us so far. And he's like, but he's really intriguing in that he's wise. He's got a work ethic. He's not afraid to, you know, be part of this world, but also won't, you know, as he says, I don't want to owe anybody anything. Right? He's really staunchly independent compared to Naaman, and when we hear all the boys talking about the money, they all hungrily take it, and Naaman asks Michael why he won't take the money, and he says, I don't want to owe anybody anything. And Naaman drops the line, which we hear later from Clay Davis as well, that I take any motherfucker's money, he giving it away. Which again tells you about Naaman, that he could be the next Clay Davis in some ways, right? Or, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not about your privilege or where you grew up or what job you have. You either have ethics or you don't. And Clay Davis is in a position of power and does not.
No.
Right? And Michael is in many ways a much better man than Clay Davis already.
Yeah. From a young age.
Yeah.
We're sort of seeing Marlowe Stansfield kind of emerge and consolidate his power in the neighborhood.
This is Eric Deggans. He's the NPR TV critic.
A more ruthless young gangster who has a different way of going about things. The cops think he hasn't killed anybody because he has two assassins who work for him who kill people and then put them in boarded up houses so they're never discovered by the police, which I thought was kind of ingenious. And those two assassins, it's such an odd connection. But I wouldn't be surprised if they were inspired a little bit by the twin assassins from the James Bond movie Diamonds Are Forever. That's what they reminded me of. And they have a very unique, you know, kind of chemistry and it's just really interesting to watch Marlowe and those two assassins to me, are three of the most compelling sort of later characters that came to the wire, you know, outside of the first season.
Just one more thing with the boys, I want to pick up, or a couple more things. We see Dookie's people very, very briefly, and again, this is the heartbreak of Dookie. The guy that answers the door is clearly not in a good state. We don't know what relation he is to Dookie, but that's the house he lives in. And the deputy head to that girl whose name I don't know, just said, make sure you give the clothes directly to Dookie, don't give it to him. So these are kids' clothes. They can't be worth much money, but already they know, give it to Dookie directly, because otherwise they're going to sell it for drugs, I guess.
I mean it's all implied, but that line tells you all you need to know about his home life. The fact that they describe him as kind of, the other kids kind of tease him for being smelly, and it's like, oh, it's so heartbreaking.
Dookie was a young man in the inner city of Baltimore, Maryland, who unfortunately had parents that weren't fit to raise him.
You're listening to Dookie himself, played by actor Jermaine Crawford.
His parents were addicted to drugs. I'm not exactly sure what drug, crack, is heroin, what it was, but his parents were addicted to drugs really bad. And it was left for the streets to raise him. And fortunately, he had a friend who saw him as a brother and kind of stepped in to kind of help just get him on the right track for as long as he could before his own life took a turn. And I just remember talking to Ed Burns once or twice about it. And, you know, as we filmed in the classrooms with, children, of course, all of them were not necessarily actors. A lot of them were children in Baltimore, children that were locally, you know, that they found just to kind of give them an opportunity and expose them to something else. And I remember Ed Burns specifically saying to me once, in one of those like weird Presbo nuance scenes in the classroom, he was just like, you know, Jermaine, like there's a lot of real life Dookies in that classroom right now. And I was just like, whoa. Cause I would sit in the hair and makeup trailer longer than everyone else, other than Julito, who had to get his ponytail laid, right? But I would be in the chair longer than everyone else, getting crud in my mouth, crud in my eyes, dirt in my hair, all these things to kind of really take me there. And I remember how that was starting to make me feel throughout the filming process, because it was starting to have a toll on me. I'm like, dang, I really feel like this character all the time. And I remember Ed Burns, when he told me that, it kind of took me out of myself and allowed me to kind of, I guess, tell Blair's story. Not really, but make it about them and not so much about me.
The other thing is, their friend Donut, the four boys' friend Donut, he must have one of the best gigs on the wire, because he's... You just steal the SUV, mate, drive it around. You must have had an absolute laugh filming the show.
When you look at Donut, he, like, especially like the first episode, he wasn't stealing any cars. You know, he wasn't, like, he was just really supposed to be, like, one of the kids, like, chilling in, like, the background.
This is the voice of Nathan Corbett, who played Donut.
When I got on set, they said that they didn't want to limit me and my potential and my charm to just really like a thumb-sucking kid, you know, who just sat in the background, because that's what Donut really was supposed to be, just sitting in the background sucking on his thumb. They loved me when I got on set, thank God, you know, and I'm thankful for that, and I'm humbled by that, and they allowed Donut to grow, you know. To be able to be one of the few comic reliefs in such a real drama, right, that has so many layers, right, I just was so thankful to be able to bring such a rare perspective or such a rare aspect of the show.
Well, I did. Apparently, David Simon said that when they got at the beginning of the season, when they got all this influx of all these kid actors, apparently it was like a bit unruly, a bit like Prez learns with all these kids flying around. Like, it was a bit hard to contain them all. But he described that by the, you know, towards the end, they all became really like professional seasoned actors.
Nice.
In many ways. But like, hats off to Alexa Fogel and the casting team. My God.
Yeah, I think it's Pat Moran here. And also Robert Chu did a lot of work with the kids.
Right.
The older I get, the more he had a special place in my heart, because I was just so stuck in what I was doing, filming, and I was so used to him just being there. and then we lost him, and I'm still kind of going forth in my life. And it's interesting you asked me that question, kind of around, you know, the same time of the passing of Chadwick Boseman. We're all on a journey. We all have an assignment, right? And I don't think Robert Chu, well, maybe he does from up there. Maybe he does for sure. But I don't think they'll ever know the impact that he had on possibly the world. You know, if you consider Michael B. Jordan, myself, Tristan, Julito. And then there was a group of all these actors in Baltimore, young actors, the Baltimore Players, that he would every year do a show, they would do a play, and he would work them like New York City meets Baltimore. Like, he was giving them industry top tier training and molding and guidance. So even with me and the Dookie performance, I would not have gotten the role if it wasn't for him. I would have not have executed the role if it was not for him. So I owe so much, you know, to the light that he shared with us. And just the older I get, the more I realize just about impact, the importance of impact. And he had such a great impact, man. He was like an angel on earth. He, nothing but positivity, nothing but laughter, nothing but great vibes. And he was a phenomenal acting coach. As you can see, we killed it. And he guided us through that. He guided us through our performances.
We went through a very intense casting process.
This is the voice of Alexa Fogel, the casting director for The Wire.
New York, Chicago, Baltimore, we looked all over the place. And once we had sort of narrowed it down, yes, Robert Chu worked with the kids, I think, a little bit around the time of their final audition. We took them all down to Baltimore to audition. I mean, they auditioned multiple times, but there was a time when we had to do it there because they were shooting the show. So Maestro had been, Harrell, who played Randy, had been sort of a song and dance guy in Chicago. Julito was from New York. Jermaine was from Baltimore. And Tristan was also in New York. When you're directing them, you have to find a way to communicate that doesn't use exactly the same kind of refined actor language that you would use with an adult. Just have to make sure it's really clear and simplify it. And depending on the age of a child, you may have to sort of trick them into it sometimes. But these kids, it was also about the chemistry between the kids. And it worked out really well. But yeah, you have to, it's a combination of seeing what's naturally there and pulling it out of them, because they can't always articulate how to do it. So sometimes it's about their instincts and putting them in a position where they can say the lines and let their natural instincts take over.
Alexa is for sure a legend, man. Her eye for talent and for actors is just by far top notch. And Pat Moran, she did a lot of work, man. Those kids, like, Alexa, of course, as you know, would cast like the big guys, right? And then Pat was the one who would just fill in the world. And Pat is like an unspoken hero on The Wire, man, because she just filled out the world. She knew Baltimore. She knew all the talent there. She knew the kids, especially our season, man. Most of those kids in that classroom were from, you know, Pat Moran's eye, man. And it filled out the world like beautifully.
I know we talked about it before, but that $200 that Marlo gave to the kids, we see Officer Walker apprehend Randy and take the money off him. And I don't know if you remember me saying, like, season two, one of my most hated characters at the time was Ziggy when I first watched The Wire. But it's not. At the end, it wasn't. You can't hate Ziggy,
yeah.
Really. Officer Walker is definitely one of the most hateable people. he will unfold in the next few episodes, but he is definitely one of the worst people in The Wire. Yeah. And yeah, look out for him, guys, because he's not a nice person.
What's your name?
Bro, man, I ain't do nothing.
I want to hear that shit. What's your goddamn name?
Randy.
Randy what?
Wagstaff.
Well, I know you ain't lying. Wouldn't nobody make that shit up. Put your hands against this fucking wall. Come on. What do you know about Hoppers bailing from a stolen car?
Nothing.
little motherfucker. You slinging.
No, sir. Swear to God.
Hell, you ain't. How else you walking around with 200 in your pocket?
My foster mother gave me that to buy school clothes with.
Your foster mother gave you 200 cash.
Yeah.
Tell her to come down to the Western, and I'll give it back to you.
I think it's a beautiful and complex question, because I try very hard as someone who trained both police officers and other folks, defenders and the like, try to be very nuanced in my answer. I think that there are Eddie Walkers in police departments all over America, all right? But I also think that there are Carvers, right, all over America in police departments. And so what I think, though, is that there is so much damage that is done by the Eddie Walkers, right, who operate unrestrained within police institutions, right? So that as a matter of national concern, there isn't enough accountability. There isn't enough see something, say something that interrupts that sort of police brutality that you see with Walker. The corruption, the stealing money, and the beating of children, and that we're all complicit, and even the Carvers and the good officers are complicit when we don't hold the Walkers accountable. Everybody knew what Walker was doing, right? What are we doing to stop that? What are we doing to stop Herc, you know, and some of his, you know, his brutal behavior? And so I think the better answer is yes, Black children experience it all across the country to different degrees, but certainly in certain heavily surveilled neighborhoods, and that there isn't enough accountability for those officers, whether they're rogue officers or whether they operate in large numbers. It almost doesn't matter. the impact on children is the same.
I lived in Baltimore. I'm vested in the city. I still live there. I live in Baltimore. I sent my kids to school there.
This is, of course, the man himself, David Simon, the creator of The Wire.
I was astounded that there were viewers who watched 5 seasons of that show, or maybe didn't watch. Maybe they watched a little of it, and that was the problem. But they came to the conclusion that the show was speaking about only Baltimore, and that Baltimore was this disastrous place that... Like, why did everybody just move? Why does everybody leave? Why would anyone try to endure here? And not only did we not feel that way, but our argument was about the necessity of the city, of everybody, of cities being the future of humanity. You know, our premise, I shouldn't even say our argument. You know, we're all going to live in cities or metropolitan areas. 80% of us do now, globally. And that number is only going to go up, and we're only going to be more compacted. We're only going to be more pluralistic. You know, the smells from the apartment down the hall are going to be food that is not your culture; it's somebody else. The prayers from the corner of mosque or synagogue or church or whatever are going to be not your prayers. We're all going to either learn to live together in increasingly compacted urban areas, or humanity is going to fail. So the idea that the city that we were critiquing the city to the point of saying everyone can just get up and walk away seemed to be the most infantile response. But there was a lot of that kind of writing in the wake of, man, Baltimore screwed up. They all moved to Philadelphia, you know. Have you been to North Philadelphia? You know, I mean, it was a really myopic response to what we did. We picked Baltimore because we lived there. I'd been a reporter there. Ed had policed it. The other writers were, you know, that from there. We spoke about the specific, but we were speaking about the general condition of at least the West in terms of, you know, learning to live with urbanity and its problems. And I was really shocked by how infantile some of the responses to. I didn't see that one coming at all. I was like, really?
Hi guys, it's Josh here in Glasgow. Season 4 of The Wire is one of the most powerful, poignant, and gut-wrenching television series in history. what those four young child actors achieved is incredible. To watch the journey of those four young boys being innocent kids to throughout the season to becoming broken boys with their lives completely altered is just miraculous, and it's a landmark of dramatic storytelling.
Thank you very much for leaving us a voicemail on our burner phone. If you want to do that as well, you have to actually send it to the phone number. It's a burner phone, so you have to do the number, and it goes like this. It goes, this is the jingle. +447 534831 658 Yeah.
You just
don't ask me to do that again.
That just came off the top of
your head. That's it. Or if you don't like sending text messages, tell them how else they can send their voice.
Yeah, use the more traditional email format, burner@thewirestrip.com, and send it there. Just like a 30-second snippet. This week we want to know, where does season 4 rank for you and why? Just a little 30-second snippet, and leave your name in there as well, so everyone hears who it's from.
Yeah, and if you want to be bumped to the top of the burner queue, then head to patreon.com/thewirestrip and join our Patreon for exclusive interviews, all like full-length interviews of all the stuff you've been hearing here, extra burner access, and
yep,
loads more.
And merch as well. There's the Wirestrip merch, which we don't have.
Yeah, where do we get our merch, Kobe? Can I have some merch?
No, you can't, because you need to be a patron.
All right. And most importantly, all of the money goes to the Ella Thompson Fund in Baltimore, which builds facilities for underprivileged children in the neighborhoods that need it most. All right, let's check in with the Major Crimes Unit, yeah, where they've got a Lester Freeman's master plan has started to unfold. So we get this great scene at the beginning this episode with the team and Rhonda, where Rhonda is not happy because she kind of lays out the problem with Lester's plan of serving all these subpoenas, and she's deliberately holding back two of them, one of them including Clay Davis, which she wants to do until after the primary, which basically to protect her own career,
yeah,
understandably enough. But it shows you how intangibly linked all the politicians are with her job, with like nobody, but like you only having this like chaotic Lester Freeman move underneath, and we also find out that he's deliberately doing it at this time. He's been biding his time.
He's been holding us for a year. Yeah. Brilliant.
It's genius.
Yes, absolutely.
It's the only time that the politicians can't do anything about it or shrug it under the carpet. And I like that Lester, you know, says to Greggs and Kima and Sidner that like, I'm happy to. Lester knows this is,
this could be the end of him.
Yeah, he's done his, you know, he's done his time. He says, "I'll go hand the subpoenas." But like, I love that Kima and Sidner are like, "Nah, man, we got your back."
Yeah, and these subpoena handing out scenes are brilliant. But
also, if I was offered the chance to hand Clay Davis a subpoena, I'd probably do it too.
Well, let's touch on that in a second. But the piece where, because Freeman's also staring down Rhonda Perlman, who's also on. They're both on the same side, and he's just like, I'm just a policeman. I don't know anything about this. Then cut to Rhonda talking to Daniels about this interaction.
I love this scene.
And Daniels just knows Freeman, knows how he's played the game. He's seen the chess move like 100 steps ahead.
Yeah.
This is how good Lester Freeman is at playing this game. And
Daniels is just so happy that it's happening to someone else. It's like, because he's been his lieutenant for too long.
Yeah, he just knows. Yeah. He knows the plays. He knows the moves, and he loves Freeman to bits. But also, he's like exasperated by this guy. So he's super happy that it's, even if it's his girlfriend, he loves this is happening to someone else.
Wonderful, yeah. And I love how Lance Reddick is so like good at the comedy in this scene. Did he do the thing with the glasses? And he looks at you like, I'm the dad you never had. It's just like, that's lovely. What I also like about that is like, you get a sense of, a very easy sense of like Rhonda and Daniels as a couple.
Yeah.
And like, they really feel really like established really gelling, as a couple. Yeah, it's like, I'm shipping them, man.
So the subpoenas, Kima gives it to the construction guy who's doing over Stringer Bell. That's kind of running the mill.
Justice!
But the
justice for Bell.
But Sidney's one to Clay Davis, I'm going to let you lead this, because this still, for me, if when I think about the scene, even like 18 years ago when I first watched it, this still fucking makes me crack up.
Drop the clip in right now. We got to do it. Everyone needs this audio.
And it's the Sphinx Club?
What the hell is this?
Subpoena for records. Sphinx Club? Man of the year.
What kind of bullshit is this? You people must be out your damn mind.
You were in the Sphinx Club. My uncle used to tin bar over there. Marvin Thompson, short guy.
What is your name, officer?
Detective Sidner, sir.
Major crimes? Shit.
Sidner never got to be a big player in this show, but like, he definitely has his moments, and this is definitely like, one. He's enjoying this
absolutely
so much. And Clayton, Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is so good in this scene. Like, the exasperation. And he delivers one of the best
It's the best one, I think.
It's got to be.
And then he obviously just jumps in his car, heads over to the mayor, and he's like, furious.
Yeah.
And he says that line, I'll take any motherfucker's... I can't say the line. Insert the line here. He says,
I'll take any motherfucker's money if he giving it away.
And that line is... This is one of the pinnacle Clay Davis episodes of The Wire.
Yeah.
Definitely is.
And I really like Clay Davis at Royce here. He's like trying to justify, like he makes himself out to be a victim.
I know.
Yeah. Right? He's like, what am I supposed to do? You think I'm supposed to get all this money from like legitimate businesses on the corners? Like the corner shop guy's going to give me all this money? Like I have to take illegitimate drug money. I just have to, man. Like Clay Davis can't imagine any other way. He just cannot fathom a world where he can be a legitimate politician, like who's straight and narrow. That's his world. He can't imagine a world that isn't corrupt.
No.
Well, you know, I mean, playing the character, I always felt, and I can say this honestly, when I play a character, I always believe that character is right.
Sheed, it's Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Clay Davis himself.
I think that's the way it's gonna have to work. I'm not gonna get into a whole breakdown of the character here. But you have to believe that you've got to be able to justify everything that you're doing. So I always felt that what he was doing was right because I could justify it in my mind. I mean, I think that's probably what helped me play the guy, is that everything that I was doing was justified. It's like, you know, when I have the rant with the mayor, you know, and it's like, well, how else am I supposed to get the money? I mean, you know, some Korean groceries. I mean, you know, if you wanted all of this money, and I went out and I got it. So I did what I had to do. And I think most guys like that think they're doing good, but they want to get paid, you know? And, the other thing is that, especially when you look at the world today, I'm no more of a crook than you know, some of the major crooks, you know, big business and things like that, where people, you know, steal lots of money, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, the stock market drops 10,000 points and you wonder where all the money went, and derivatives and all of this. I mean, I think I explain it in one of the last episodes that I do, where I say, look, I'm small potatoes compared to the big picture, and you've got to follow the money. But coming after me is easy. It's going after the big guys. That's what's going to be hard.
So we meet Cuddy.
We meet Cuddy again. And yeah, in two scenes, two good scenes here. He's still mowing lawns with the Spaniards.
But now he speaks loads of Spanish.
He speaks.
Which I really enjoy.
He knows the swear. He's been watching Cheech and Chong and he's learned the swear words, basically. That's what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. I love this. I love watching, like, just like with Carver, the character progression between seasons. Like, we see how far they've come between season 3 and 4. Because like, we watched Cuddy on the back of this same van last year being this absolute fish out of water.
Yeah.
You know, And now he's just joking about. He's doing the work. It's like, oh God, Cuddy's the best.
And his chief, I can't remember what that guy's name is, but he's saying, this is another parallel. So we had the parallel saying, I'll take any motherfucker's money if they're giving it away. Naaman and Clay Davis. And this is what, this is the same parallel here with Bubbles saying to Sherrod, we could be dividing and conquering more if you knew how to take.
Yeah, you're right.
And this is what the guy says to Cutty. You know, you could get your own crew. We could we can spread out.
It's it's this entrepreneurial sort of spirit. And you see the same in Randy. He's got it too.
Yeah. And we see Cutty here. He's enjoying his life in the day, but he's also enjoying his life when we go to the boxing gym, and it's buzzing.
Yeah, it's so nice to see, isn't it? Yeah. He's really made a
That $12,000 he got from illicit drugs means.
Let's not talk about that. Off. And he's got the poster of Avon up there, which I thought was a nice touch.
I think that must have been a condition of the money
transfer. The 12 grand, I still love that, not to go back to season 3, but that scene where he gets that money and Avon's just like, man, of course. Just like that's pittance. And it's just like, I love that. And I love that he's done that little ode to Avon.
Yeah, of course.
On the wall.
And Cutty's there, and he's getting hit on by all the
love this.
all the mothers of the boxers.
The Wire does know it's comedy.
It does
so well.
He does try to fend them off a bit.
Slipping off into the great beyond, and I hope it's a long time from now. And I hope my family and friends are all gathered around my bed to say goodbye. And it's been a great life. I hope the last words in my ear, telling me I can close my eyes and quit, are going to be from Chad Colby. I hope they just usher him in the room and go, Chad, you're up. Send him out.
Love playing Cuddy, and I love Calvin Ford, the real Cuddy, for what he was able to do in the community and give these kids a place. And I saw firsthand, because I had to go to Upton Boxing Gym and work with him every day. So I was actually there when Gervonta Tank Davis was 7 years old, pounding away. And I was like, who is that little dude? And Calvin said, that's going to be my champion. And cut two, he is his champion, right? He's the people's champion. So I saw it. I saw him be afraid that he was going to lose him to the streets. And I saw many of them who didn't come back. So it's very real. That foundation is huge.
I loved it. It was a good input. Once again, big kudos to the writers, because there's so many kids with those dreams that really are talented but get caught up. You got the gym right here in the neighborhood. When you step out, it's heroin, cocaine, guns.
You're listening to Anwan Glover, who played Slim Charles.
You either gonna pick up some boxing gloves, or you're gonna pick up a pistol, or you're gonna pick up some cocaine. So it's a three-way street. They always say it's a one-way street, but you come out that one way, it's three ways to get in trouble. You can either go the right way, this way, or that way. You know? So it was beautiful. And then Chad, we had so much chemistry. That was another thing. We had so much chemistry on, and he's actually funny as hell. He used to make me they get ready to say Ashley, he'd be like, blah, blah, blah. He'd just be making some funny, and I'd be like, wait. He was so funny, Chad. And then I talk to Chad all the time as well. Chad he's super smart too. He just, his character fitted right in. He was like, look, I ain't with that no more, man. I'm just going to work with the kids at the boxing gym. And you cool with that, man? We need some money. So we went and sat with Avon. He was like, that's all you need? $10,000? Let's go get him $10,000. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't nothing, but he was one of those guys, and we went on to do other stuff. We didn't audition for tons of stuff together. We did a few videos together. He's just a super all around guy. Older, he's more knowledgeable, and you can learn from him every day.
We love Cutty. Yeah. Cutty him back.
And they start to cleverly overlay some of the plots here. So we see Michael and Naaman at Cutty's gym.
Yeah.
Michael, and just like with Marlo and Bodie, we see through Cuddy's eyes. Cuddy sees the potential in Michael as well.
It's the last piece we'll head to. It's just a touch on the schools from the teacher side.
So we see Prez getting his class. Oh God, Prez.
Well, first, before the class, he's been inducted a bit by some of the other teachers.
Oh yeah, and they tell him this is where the title of the episode comes from, right?
Yeah, soft eyes. You need soft eyes.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think every teacher goes into this, maybe like politicians as well, thinking wide-eyed, I'm going to impart my knowledge onto these kids and they're going to accept it and become better people, and therefore that's my contribution to the world. But their conversations with him are all about keeping the room warm so they're drowsy.
Do
you know what I mean? And it's like...
it's about control rather than... yeah. But they know the realities. It's also interesting that they're all obsessed with like double spacing and consistency. Like nobody's talking about how best to approach these kids other than to keep them dozy, like you say. It's like, that's not on the agenda.
Not at all. And like you say, he goes to his room and starts cleaning up.
I love the scene. And they throw a bit of Johnny Cash.
I was going to say, was that the same music from the start of that montage?
Oh my God, you're right. When he's putting the board up.
Yeah, when he's putting stuff on the chipboard.
Is it the same? Oh, guy, we should know this. We're the Wire podcast. Somebody tell us.
Producer Tom coming, yo. Producer Tom coming. Producer Tom coming.
Yeah, it's Johnny Cash. Ring of Fire, right?
If it's not the same Johnny Cash track, it is a Johnny Cash track, I'm sure. Oh, you're so right. This is Prez. Prez likes his order and control. Yeah, he created the board, the cork board back in the day. What I like about this is like, this is Prez coming. This scene just generates so much like optimism, and this like he's done a great job. He's cleaning a bit like Cuddy at the gym last season. It's that sense of newness, the sense of like possibility that he's got, and I think what's interesting that's kind of what a lot of this season is. It's like the epigraph of the first episode was Lambs to the Slaughter. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, that could apply to the boys and their lives and this neighborhood and what the roads that they might end up on. It applies to Prez coming in as he's a lamb to the slaughter. He's no idea what he's going up against.
Yeah.
It applies to Carchetti, who's also new to this, running for mayor. He's also, it's not going well. There's a sense of this season of like how all these things start from the beginning, right? We're seeing the beginning of the childhood. It's the beginning of somebody's teaching career. It's like, and the challenges that somebody new to any of these environments are going to face.
Okay, guys, that was season 4, episode 2, Soft Eyes. Hope you enjoyed that. Lots of people to fit in that episode. There's a lot of people we spoke to, and it's great and exciting.
Our episodes are going to have to be longer than the Wire episodes at this rate, because there's just too many good interviews to pack in.
That's a big bugbear of yours, isn't it? If a podcast episode is longer than the TV show or film, that's a no-no for you, isn't it?
That's my rule of thumb that I've been trying to get everyone to stick to, but I might just have to throw that out the window this season, because it's just too damn good. And a big thank you to all those people that we were lucky enough to speak to, and thanks to everyone for lending us your time. And a big thank you to the people at Sonics who are providing the transcribing software. And if you want to use that, head to sonics.ai/invite/stripped.
Yeah, cheers to @BlackSnowComics on Instagram. That's @BlackSnowComics. He made the really cool picture of the Four Boys of Summer, which is our main podcast logo this year. He's also known as Michael Balistreri.
And a huge thank you, as always, to Martin and Sam from the Song by Song podcast, who made our amazing theme music with Tom Waits' help, of course.
Yeah, with Tom Waits' help. Thanks loads to producer Obi, who has really pulled this whole thing together. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Obi, and thank you to our the man of the sky, Mr. Tom Wally, the voice in the elevator, the fact checker himself.
Yeah, I would just like to finish with a few kind of plugs. Do follow us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram. We are @TheWireStripped.
Or you can join our Patreon, as mentioned, patreon.com/TheWireStripped.
And don't forget to review on your favorite podcast app, such as Apple Podcasts, such as Spotify, such as Amazon, such as Overcast, such as Pocket Casts. There's many, many.
One of those ones. And we will see you next week for episode 3, homerooms.
Homerooms.
Something we don't have here.
We do. Do you know a form room?
Do we? No. I feel like we're talking about this on the episode. I'm getting deja vu now.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.